Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded April 30th, 2025, and happy impending International Workers' Day all over the world outside of North America. May 1st is the day for those who toil to rest and recognize without their labors, civilization stops. It's a simple and obvious truth. The powers that be, which shouldn't be, spend enormous amounts of time and fortunes obscuring from the public's cognition. Obviated, too, is the parallel purpose of the original May Day, peace. The robot intelligence informs, in 1889, the Second Socialist International designated May 1st as a day of international workers' struggle, including calls for an eight-hour day, universal suffrage, and world peace. 136 years later, the need for peace has never been greater. Meanwhile, opposite sides of the Russo-American war are talking peace, though how seriously remains a matter of conjecture. What is certain, however, as the principles posture, the little people, those whose work maintains the world, are paying the price of this protracted conflict. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and now the freshly released Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. Today, John Helmer writing Russia is ready for a bad deal with Trump for good Russian reasons, and more insight into the backroom maneuverings between the erstwhile rivals to remake the post-Cold War world. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Well, John, happy May Day, I guess I should say as well. And there is another day of great import on the Russian calendar coming up. May the 9th marks Victory Day, the commemoration of the defeat of German Nazism. As they did with Easter and last year and this year, Russia's unilaterally declared a ceasefire, this time for 3 days over the period that marks Victory Day. John, how has Ukraine, and more importantly, its sponsors, responded so far, at least, to this overture by Russia?
In two or three different ways, Chris, to answer your question directly, and then I'll do some background. Your retired U.S. Army General Keith Kellogg has gone out in front, speaking, as he said, for the president, but speaking for the Ukrainians, to describe the three-day ceasefire as absurd. He said that on Fox News on Tuesday, and he added that it makes no sense to have a three-day ceasefire. Russia is not winning the war. Implication, Ukraine can win the war if we stick with them. Second, Russia has failed, I'm quoting Kellogg to say, the Russian army has failed to take Kiev, has failed to take Odessa, has moved meters, not miles. And President Trump is right on the money, according to Kellogg. This is what he wants. And then Kellogg was backed up by Zelensky's statement and the foreign minister's statement and other statements in the supportive press saying, why wait for a three-day ceasefire when you can have a ceasefire right now? And we want an unconditional all-theater ceasefire for 30 days. And that's a challenge to the Russians. That's what the reaction has been. It's not quite dismissive, not totally dismissive, but it ignores the sequencing that the Ukrainians and the Americans agreed since last week when Zelensky met for his 15-minute chat in St. Peter's Basilica. And let's just do that background quickly as an answer to your question as well. What happened there was entirely a PR stunt, which had been scripted principally by Trump and a party crashed by Macron and Starmer. What happened was that it had been decided already in the Rome morning by the White House and Trump to start showing Trump's leaning towards Zelensky as a photo opportunity, as a tactical operation. That morning, Trump tweeted a hostile tweet against Putin. Why had he fired at civilians? He hadn't, but he doesn't tell the truth. And he expressed impatience with Putin and criticism. That happened the Rome morning. A couple of hours later, Trump shows up for the funeral ceremonies for the Pope. And it appears in the Basilica that the priests handling the arrangements had set out three chairs. Whether the third chair was for Macron or whether it was for Starmer, it violated the fundamental Trump PR objective to show that he dominated St. Peter's, he dominated Zelensky, he dominated the peacemaking that was to follow. So you can see, if you follow carefully, the priests removing the chair after Macron greets both Trump and Zelensky. Starmer comes in to do the same. And then we have the Trump sit down with Zelensky. Trump then heads towards the aeroplane, flies home, and on the way, he tells reporters in what the White House is calling a press gaggle, a very good description of what they do, an unserious press conference of a type. Trump was again hostile and negative towards Putin and said, why doesn't he? I expect him to hurry up and settle this deal. We're on the edge. Then Rubio, was the Secretary of State, was ordered to go on television. He did on the Sunday and explain that that Trump wants to be the peacemaker like the Pope, and that they ran the line that it's up, the ball's in the Russian court, it's up to Putin to hurry up, we won't wait forever, we're trying to determine who's serious about peace and who isn't. The entire tilt was aimed at Russia's to blame if peace fails, if Trump, having tried, fails. Then this is all following the Witkoff visit to the Kremlin on the Friday morning, and it indicated that it was the Americans who were upset and angry, if anything, that Putin had not agreed to the term sheet that Witkoff put on the table at the time. So the next part of the sequence is that Lavrov goes on CBS television to say, we're not going to discuss the terms in detail on television. We'll leave it to the other side, meaning Zelensky, the British, the French, and Trump himself, to announce. We will tell you that Crimea is not on the table, and there are some other issues that of general security, which we require to be discussed. In other words, a comprehensive settlement all at once, not piece by piece, and that the ceasefires that had already been attempted and offered and implemented by the Russian side in response to Trump had failed by Ukrainian violation. So the Russian position was, Trump, you want to push us? Okay, you prove that if we declare a ceasefire, you can control and order your Ukrainian fellows to honor the ceasefire. So that's exactly what Putin did in announcing the ceasefire, adding for domestic consumption as well as American consumption two points. One is, if the Ukrainians violate, our military will respond appropriately. That meant a challenge. Trump, show you can control the Ukrainian guns. If you can't, there's no point in a deal. It's worthless. Second, Putin said, the negotiations for which we're ready to discuss without preconditions must address the root causes. That was Putin's phrase. Root causes mean the expansion of NATO, not only across the Ukrainian battlefield, but across all France, from the south, from the north, across Finland, and into the Arctic from Greenland, and in the Far East from Japan and South Korea. So it was a challenge from Putin for Trump to put up or shut up. What subsequently happened is that the Americans see what he's done, the Europeans see what Putin has done, and reject it. They don't like the test. They're not serious. They are pretending to make peace, and they want to put the pressure on Putin to do more, understanding that there are factions in the Kremlin and in Moscow that want peace on US and European conditions. And that explains Kellogg's dismissal. And there's been a reply in the last few hours from Moscow on that. Dmitry Peskov, the Putin spokesman, announced a significant change of line. He said, speaking to reporters, "We are grateful to the United States to act as a mediator." Now, the Russian line has been not that the US is a mediator. Russia is not negotiating with Vitkov as a mediator, or at least he's a mediator between Putin and Trump, but he's not a mediator for a war settlement. Why? Because Russia understands, has said many times, everybody should understand, this is a war between the United States and Russia. Now, all of a sudden, Peskov, responding to the sequence, says, "We're grateful to the United States for acting as a mediator, but we believe this war can be settled by direct negotiations between the Ukraine and Russia. And consequently, the Ukraine should drop or revoke its law preventing just such a thing, direct negotiations." So the Russian side has thrown another spanner in the Anglo-American, Franco-American, German-American works by saying, if you want to act as proxies, go ahead, but we're testing whether you can control Ukraine, and we'll talk to Ukraine directly because you chaps can't show that you're behind any ceasefire at all. So that's where we are, and you can wait for the developments in the next hour or two.
Yeah, things are certainly changing fast, and something like the death of a pope it's hardly a blip in the news cycle nowadays. It seems, I'm sure that Trump wants to be seen as doing God's work, just like the pope. Me and that guy, I can see him saying, and you know, like seeing them in St. Peter's. You talk about the money changers in the temple. I've seen remarks that this indicates that the people that control the Vatican are going to be much more amenable to the American/European position with the next pope, more so than Francis was. Is that position, the European and American position, identical when it comes to what's going on in Ukraine and this effort towards peace? And as you say, the Americans haven't shown if they're interested in controlling the Ukraine forces. As far as the ceasefire goes, like there's been the past 30 days where the Russians had declared their end to the what you call the electric war, and they were fired on almost immediately after declaring that cessation.
It's a good question. I agree with your opinion. Just to emphasize it, are the Europeans, but principally Germany, France, and the UK, walking in a different direction for war with Russia from the direction Trump is walking in? Or are they walking arm in arm but don't want to make it appear so? And that what we're seeing as a difference between the European term sheet on ending the war, which was discussed in London and previously Paris with Kellogg, with Vitkov a week ago, is that genuinely different and opposed to the Americans? I'd say no, it's not genuinely different. And what we're seeing is a combination of PR from the Europeans, who are primarily at odds with Trump over trade and tariff issues. That's the first part. And second, they resent Trump's forcing them, compelling the vassals to pay for the protection. Of course, the Europeans understand that that's a racket. They don't want to be forced to increase their defense budgets at the price of cutting their social welfare budgets, raising taxes, and hurting their political base. So the Germans, the French, and the British are all losing votes by appearing to go along with Trump on these fundamental domestic policy issues which Trump is putting on them. On the other hand, the arm-in-arm hand, or elbow-on-elbow, or feet-by-feet, boots on the ground, so to speak, I see them working in partnership. Basically, Trump is saying, you will continue the war against Russia. I will be the peacemaker. You will come along with me. We will establish that Russia is not a genuine peacemaker and deserves more war, deserves a continuation of war. The United States will continue to support the Ukraine with arms, with financing, with intelligence sharing, and will continue to act in partnership with Germany, France, and the UK on the battlefield and in the rear, in Poland, for example. That partnership will be paid for to Trump, to US arms suppliers, to US businesses, and so on, by the Europeans. So that's underlying the arrangements is a war plan, but a war plan that's sequenced in time. And there have been very clear indications in Washington that Trump's advisors are following a sequencing plan, reduce the U.S. commitment in the war against Europe in order to do more in the war against China, one war at a time, but the Russia war to be paid for by the Europeans, and not simply by the Europeans. What Trump is encouraging is increased rearmament of Germany, a rearmament that's as big as Hitler's 1920s, 1930s rearmament of Germany. Rearmament of Germany under the new Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, and the new Foreign Minister, Johann Wadephul, a combination of Russia haters, Russia war fighters, who intend to rearm Germany to fight Russia again. And that'll be funded by Germans and the Europeans. The money will flow to the United States, and Trump will support it. In that sense, I would say Trump is doing in secret the rearmament of Germany to fight Russia again.
Well, you mentioned Rubio. Now, when Rubio was in Rome, he made a couple of pronouncements. And firstly, he says, we want to end the war, meaning the Ukraine war. But he also said something. He says that how lucky we are, I'm paraphrasing, that we have a president who wants to end and prevent wars. When you're talking about a protection racket, there was something in that sentence that made me think that Rubio was threatening some new wars if people didn't go along with the Trump program.
I agree with you. I think you've read it correctly, Chris. The rest of the mass media don't read it correctly. I don't think that the new Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, differs either. It's a rearmament to fight Russia, then China, and it's a rearmament to be justified for domestic populations facing rising energy prices, inflation, loss of standard of living, disruptions of standard of living, the collapse of health systems, the collapse of education systems. The domestic populations of Britain and Europe can't cope with the amount of sacrifice being inflicted on them by individuals like Macron, Merz, Starmer, and before Merz, of course, Scholz, including the Greens. The domestic populations of these countries are suffering terribly from this war policy. So it has to be justified to the domestic populations. And the same in the United States. Trump purports to be the peacemaker, while he purports to impose tariffs to replace taxation, tariffs to increase the cost of living with tax cuts for his friends. This is a huge hoax. It's a huge deception, not simply a deception invented by the British, who think they're good at special information operations, deception operations, lies like the Novichok. No. This is much bigger. The Trump deception is we're going to inflict war on our targets, first Russia, then China, along the way Iran, and we're going to make the European public pay for it, and we're going to make the US public pay for it, but we're not going to take the blame for it. We're going to stay in power to do it. And that's what's happening. A colossal hoax, a colossal deception, which is covering up imperial war in escalation, not peacemaking, not Pope type peacemaking, and not I rule the world type peacemaking. It's I rule the world type war making. That's what Trump told the Atlantic on the telephone late last week. I rule the country. I rule the world. And if the country doesn't like it, he's got dictatorial powers that he plans to use. And he's applied to the Supreme Court of the United States to endorse that dictatorial power, including the power to use force domestically, force abroad, under Article 2 of the Constitution.
Yeah, let's talk about that. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears and has as well served as advisor to governments at the highest level and worked in academia. His book titles include The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and the newly released Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. Well, there's sanctions and there's tariffs. And beyond that, there's outright sabotage. Germany's hawkish acting foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, has said just yesterday that there's no way that she's going to allow, if she can, Nord Stream pipeline reopening. I'm curious, John, as far as sanctions go, as far as Russia is concerned, would ending sanctions be a good thing for Russia economically, or is there more danger for their economy posed by renewing things like Nord Stream and orienting again their economy to the West?
Good question again, Chris. And this is a question that's being debated quietly in Moscow, among Moscow decision makers. On the one hand, the official position is that, and it's apparently on the Witkoff term sheet that was presented in the Kremlin, Russia insists that as part of an end-of-war settlement on the Ukraine battlefield, the sanctions imposed since 2014 should be lifted. Now, the U.S., technically, the U.S. can lift its sanctions only by application to Congress. Trump can't do it by executive order, and he can't force the Europeans to lift their sanctions. What Trump can do instead is, by executive order, stop enforcement of the U.S. sanctions. And that would open such a wide loophole, it would essentially make the European sanctions and the U.S. sanctions in force unenforceable, and therefore Russian oil and gas and other coal and other forms of trade and financing would sail right through that loophole. So dropping sanctions is a crucial part of the deal, so to speak. At the same time, Russians have replaced Russian businessmen, Russian business interests, Russian networks, have replaced all the US and European firms that left Russia as part of the anti-war sanctions movement since 2022. And there is now created a significant lobby around Putin saying, we don't want a revival of European and American imports. We don't want McDonald's to come in, Coca-Cola to return, and so forth, because that they will damage our established business interests. So there is a strong argument that Russia has achieved a level of self-sufficiency across the board, which would be imperiled by any return of the Americans and any return of the Europeans. And Putin has given instructions, and this is a way of saying that there's a collective ministerial cabinet level agreement, that the terms on which any individual foreign company should return must be adjusted to domestic interests. They chose to leave. They should pay a price for return. At the same time, your question was, would Russian economy prosper? Well, certainly Russian economic prosperity would be enhanced if the international payment system using dollars through the SWIFT financial transfer system were restored. Certainly Russia wants to see the return of the $300 billion in central bank assets, which were frozen and are being now used in the interest is being used. The interest income is being used to fund by the Europeans to fund the Ukraine, and by the Canadians, I believe, too, to fund the Kiev regime. The return of those reserves would leave the Ukraine stranded and the Europeans stranded for new cash, which they'd have to extract from their own populations. So the term sheets differ on what a reconstruction of post-war Ukraine would mean and who would pay for it. Obviously, the Ukrainians and the Europeans say Russia should pay for it. Russia thinks that the war makers should pay for it. In any event, there's no agreement on things as complicated as that. And that's why Dmitry Peskov said this morning, you can't settle all these complicated issues in the time frame that Trump is insisting on. So here we go back to your question. There is an argument for Russia to continue its self-sufficiency against European and American imports, to continue its orientation towards new markets, as well as China and Southeast Asia and Africa. But most of the sanctions that apply to preventing Russian trade and shipping moving would be beneficial for the Russian economy. Yes, it would. And so we have a Putin representative, Kirill Dmitriev, about whom we've spoken in the past. Call him the representative of Russian oligarchs and the Russian new business, who don't see necessarily eye to eye on what their interests would be if sanctions are lifted, representing the business interests of Russia in negotiations with Witkoff, who represents the American counterpart money bags, people like Bezos, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, and the like, and in an attempt to find payoffs to their clients. And so we have an argument, a discussion, a debate over which sanctions to drop first and who should benefit first and who should benefit later. That's not an argument that can be resolved anytime quickly, and it's or anytime soon. And it's a political argument on which the political succession in France, the UK, and Russia depend.
Well, again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. We're going to take a brief break. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. We're talking in and around his article, Russia is Ready for a Bad Deal with Trump for Good Russian Reasons, and some of his other work that's up this week. Lots going on, lots changing. We'll be back in 1 minute. When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, discover that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
For
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's also the most frequently appearing guest on this program over the last 25 years or so, and some that it's been on the air, online, and